The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We'll meet again, don't know where.
Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada, on June 18th, Thursday. Vera Lynn, who sings that song, We'll Meet Again. There'll be birds over the white cliffs of Dover. And a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. Vera Lynn died at 103 yesterday. I thought I'd begin the show today by reminding us we're all mortal, even people who sing immortal songs. Good morning to you. There's a lot of news for today's The Rundown. Let me get to it. Secretary of State Michael Pompeo continues his meetings in Hawaii with his Chinese counterpart over the strained relationship in Beijing and Washington, D.C., over Hong Kong, Taiwan, and many other issues. Those are important meetings and not getting a lot of attention, but I'll bring you up to speed with whatever happens there if anything is announced in the course of this morning's show. In a move that is guaranteed to reelect Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado, the Senate voted to guarantee $900 million in funding for conservation acquisition. It's a Cory Gardner bill replenishing the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Big win for Cory Gardner. Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve says the stimulus measures have to be renewed by July. I wrote about this in the Washington Post yesterday. In order to keep the recovery going, I think that will be a prod to the Senate to do just that. The EPA announced yesterday they're not going to regulate perchlorate. Now, I always have to note, my son works at the EPA, so I have a conflict of interest, but I declare it. This rulemaking, which is not a rulemaking, it's an intention not to do a rulemaking, has enormous economic consequences for the recovery for everyone who is afraid of a rule regulating perchlorate. That was a favorite of Team Obama Biden. And if Team Obama Biden comes back in the form of Joe Biden, the front man for AOC and the whole left wing of the Democratic Party, expect them to regulate perchlorate and everything else. But in the meantime, economic growth will not be obscured. Major League Baseball, yesterday I was bemoaning that it was not going to happen. Well, last night, they appear to have reached an agreement on a 60-game season beginning July 19th. That is the good news of the morning. The Justice Department is proposing limiting internet company protections, according to the Wall Street Journal. This will probably have the farthest-reaching effect on your life. The proposal will remove legal protections when platforms facilitate or solicit third-party content or activity that violates federal criminal law, according to the Wall Street Journal, such as online scams and trafficking, illicit or counterfeit drugs. Internet companies would lose immunities if they acknowledge that unlawful conduct is taking place on their platform and they show reckless disregard for how users are behaving on their sites. Without those legal protections, tech companies could be exposed to claims for monetary damages from people allegedly harmed by online fraud and other illegal activity. That will mean they have to completely increase their hands-off approach right now. The department, DOJ, also wouldn't confer immunity to platforms in instances involving online child exploitation and sexual abuse, terrorism, or cyberstalking. It's a bill that I think is going to fly through Congress. Remember Danny Masterson in That 70s Show? He played Hyde. He's been charged with raping three women in incidents that occurred between 2001 and 2003. Don't ask me why it took so long, but Hyde is in trouble. Now, the big story of the morning, of course, is John Bolton. Justice Department sued last night to stop the publication of John Bolton's book In the Room Where It Happened. The Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal all cover the book extensively. It's got, I would say, grade B allegations in it. that he asked President Xi to help him with re-election, that he didn't like Jim Mattis very much, that Mike Pompeo said something bad about the president. All I know is that the New York Times hated the book. That tells you that the book does not deliver. Look, I haven't seen the book. They didn't send me the book. Everyone in D.C.'s got the book except me, but apparently the ambassador knew I wouldn't read it because it hadn't been pre-cleared. And I will not read a book that isn't pre-cleared, can get people killed if it's got classified information in it. And when it eventually publishes, I'll read it. But I did enjoy the review because the review can't possibly have classified information in it, because I read the review and I said there can't be anything in it. And someone told me, some reporter yesterday said, you know, there can't be classified information in it because the Trump administration says it contains lies. And if they're lies, lies aren't classified. I said, oh, you're so wrong, because so many lies are classified because they're lies of people who are under surveillance or sources and methods that include lies within them. And so I just don't deal with books that haven't gone through pre-review classification. So I won't be covering it. But I do want you to, I won't be reading it until after it's disclosed, but I do want you to hear what the New York Times had to say about it. The New York Times didn't like it at all. It said John Bolton may be the last person many Americans wish to hear from right now. Not that he would ever deign to make any concessions to what a reader might want. And so it begins with a slap at John Bolton. The room where it happened, an account of the 17 months as Trump's national security advisor, has been written with so little discernible attention to style and narrative that Bolton apparently presumes an audience is hanging on his every word. Known as a fastidious note taker, Bolton has filled his book's nearly 500 pages with minute and often extraneous details, including the time and length of routine meetings and even at one point a nap. Underneath it all, of course, is a festering obsession with his enemies, both abroad, Iran, North Korea, and at home, the media, the high-minded, the former Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. The book is bloated with self-importance, even though it mostly recounts as Bolton not being able to accomplish very much. It toggles between two discordant registers, exceedingly tedious and slightly unhinged. Still, it may be a fitting combination for a lavishly bewhiskered figure whose wonkishness and warmongering can make him seem like an unlikely hybrid of Ned Flanders and Yosemite Sam. Thus does the abiding hatred for Bolton trump the paragraphs intended in his book to wound Donald Trump. One day story. Now, the headline of the Washington Post is Trump asks Xi to help him win re-election. The Wall Street Journal says Trump put re-election prospects ahead of the national interest, Bolton alleges. And I think it's a one day story. And I believe John will have. I like the ambassador a lot. I read his previous book. He is detail oriented, but I'm not going to read it till it's cleared. And I don't think you ought to either. I take that very seriously. I also have sort of the Nixon approach to this. If you work for Team Nixon, you never talk about what happens in the room where it happens. The premise of the song, The Room Where It Happens, is that no one ever talked about the room where it happens because it's just not what's done. I've been 40 years since I worked for President Nixon and 30 years since I worked for President Reagan. I've written 14 books. I don't talk about it. An Atlanta police officer was charged with felony murder in the death of Rashard Brooks yesterday. Felony murder means you can get the death penalty in Georgia. Also, Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben's, which are rooted in racist imagery, are changing, according to PepsiCo, their brands. The owner of these supermarket staples, much like the owners of the classic film Gone with the Wind and popular TV shows, are rethinking their products and marketing, according to the Wall Street Journal this morning. And in the Telegraph of Great Britain comes news that northern towns are leading the post-coronavirus property surge. This is happening in Maine, by the way, in Tennessee and other places where New Yorkers and Beltway people are fleeing to buy second homes away from urban crush, acting because they have money on the impulse, let's get away from the virus. Doesn't make a lot of sense, but it is actually happening. So what are markets doing? This is brought to you by Birch Gold. To get your portfolio diversified, which you ought very much to have done already and you need to do now, you send my name, Hugh, to 474747. Text it, for Hugh to 47-47-47. And Birch Gold, which has got the best rating from the Bed Air Business Bureau and thousands of thumbs-up reviews, will send you all the information on rolling over a portion of your IRA or 401k. Or you can buy gold directly from Birch Gold. You can also visit HughGold.com. Birch Gold is the place to get precious metals into your portfolio, either your retirement portfolio or your safety deposit box, one way or the other. Yesterday, we had a mixed market. The Dow was down 170 points, the NASDAQ was up 14, and the S&P was down 11. Overnight, not much going on in the world. The England index is down 0.11%. The German index is down 0.3%. Overnight, the Japan index closed down 0.45%. Light crude is up to $38 a barrel. Gold is down just a tick to 1732. And the 10-year bond is at 0.73%, remains the best time ever for mortgages. But my bottom line remains my bottom line every morning when I tell you what happened in markets yesterday and overseas during the night. For a morning show, I can't tell you what's going to happen in the market today. All I can tell you is you got to own some gold. And you got to go to Birch Gold to do that. Where it happened, no one else was in the room where it happened. The room where it happened, the room where it happened. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. The Room Where It Happened is John Bolton's new book, and the Department of Justice is sued to stop its publication. Very hard to win a prior restraint. And so watch that space. I don't think they'll win the prior restraint. It's very difficult to win the prior restraint, even if there is classified information in there, unless it can be shown that there would be an immediate consequence that I think threatens someone's individual life or safety, though. Might be hard for a court to reach that decision. I'll keep you posted if a decision comes down in the course of the show. Yesterday, the big moment came on the Senate floor. First of all, good old dumb Dick Durbin of Illinois got up and made this statement on the Senate floor. Dick Durbin, of course, white man from Chicago, talking about Tim Scott, black man from South Carolina, cut number 10.
We have fought this issue in America for over 400 years. That's how long slavery. It's been since slavery came to our shores, and the racism that followed from it was part of it, is still very much alive in America and seen in video after video. And these younger people are telling us once and for all, change it, grown-ups. You're supposed to be in charge. You're supposed to have the authority. So what we say on the Democratic side is we cannot waste this historic moment, this singular opportunity. Let's not do something that is a token, half-hearted approach. Excuse me.
He called Tim Scott's proposed bill a token, half-hearted approach. Senator Scott, this will take most of the next three segments. Senator Scott took to the Senate floor. Let's begin to play cut number 11.
Mr. President, this morning, I woke up this morning, Mr. President, Wednesday morning, June 17th. 2020. For so many Americans, this is just another Wednesday morning. You wake up, you get ready for work. Not in South Carolina. In South Carolina, this Wednesday, June 17th, is the fifth anniversary of when a racist walked into Mother Emanuel Church. And sat through a Bible study for an hour and listened to believers talk about their love of God. And at the end of that Bible study, pulled out the weapon and killed 9 people. So for me, and so many South Carolinians, this is a hard day.
Start right there. I will be back. I'm going to complete Senator Scott's speech. I did not interrupt it. I did not tell you that was Senator Scott struggling to command his emotions, because I wanted you to hear them as he got command of himself. And I want you to hear the rest of his remarks, which I will play in the next 2 segments. Dick Durbin ought not to have called Senator Scott's measures a token. Dick Durbin is an idiot. Senator Scott is a noble and an esteemed figure in Washington, D.C., on both sides of the aisle, and his bill should pass immediately. That Democrats are not passing it immediately is because they wish to score political points off of race. Senator Scott wishes to work the problem. I would trust Senator Scott on this, America. And stay tuned, because I'm going to play you the rest of what Senator Scott had to say yesterday. Dick Durbin or no Dick Durbin. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Thursday morning edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Yesterday, United States Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, an African-American, took to the floor to talk about the bill that he introduced in criminal reform. Dick Durbin called it a token bill. Senator Scott continued his response after an emotional ingathering about the momentousness of the anniversary of the Mother Emanuel shooting, which approaches.
I'll tell you, Mr. President, that standing on this floor, remembering the words of one of the victim's son, Daniel Simmons Jr., 5 years ago, a Wednesday had passed, 1 week later. And I asked Daniel Simmons Jr., whose father, Daniel Simmons Sr., had been killed in an attempt to start another race war at the home of the Civil War. I asked him, what should I say to the people who will be watching around the country? He said what I could not believe, which was, please remind them of Romans 8:28, that all things work together for good, for those who love God and are called according to their purpose. I was standing at those doors on my cell phone. I could not believe the words he was speaking. And in an act of true, unconditional love, he inspired me, he encouraged me, he taught me lessons of strength and courage and mercy our nation needs to remember. And I came to the floor today, Mr. President, to speak about my new bill, the Justice Act, our Republican response to the police reform. And I was sitting in my office when the senator from Illinois talked about the token legislation. On this day, the day that we remember Mother Emanuel Church and the 9 lost lives, my friend, the pastor of the church, Clemente Pinckney, the first person ever to call me a senator, the pastor of that church, a Democrat pastor of that church, says to me, my senator, 2012, December, to reflect back on the fact that I have in my phone today the text from Clemente where I said, are you okay? He didn't answer because he was already dead. to think that on this day, as we try to make sure that fewer people lose confidence in this nation, to have the senator from Illinois refer to this process, this bill, this opportunity to restore hope and confidence and trust from the American people, from African Americans, from communities of color, to call this a token process, hurts my soul for my country, for our people. To think that the concept of anti-lynching that's a part of this legislation to be considered a token piece of legislation, because perhaps I'm African American and I'm the only one on the side of the aisle, I don't know what he meant. But I can tell you that this day, to have those comments again, hurts the soul. To think about how the same year, 2015, Walter Scott, in my hometown of North Charleston, running away from the police, gets shot 5 times in the back. I sponsored legislation then, and I don't remember a single person saying a single thing on that side of the aisle about helping to push forward more legislation on body cameras. But today, this is a token piece of legislation. Because I think it's important that we stand up and be counted and make sure that we have more resources available for every single officer to have a body camera. Because as we saw in Georgia with Mr. Arbery, had it not been caught on video, in Walter Scott's case, had it not been caught on video, in George Floyd's case, had it not been caught on video, we might be in a different place. But on the other side, they're wanting to race bait on tokenism, while this legislation will provide resources for body cameras, for anti-lynching, for de-escalation training. But no, we can't concern ourselves with the families I sat with at the White House yesterday and in my office yesterday. Instead, we want to play politics, because this is 2020 and we're far more concerned about winning elections than we are having a serious conversation on reform in this country. No, we would rather have a conversation about tearing this country apart, making it a binary choice between law enforcement and communities of color, instead of working for the American people, bringing the reforms to the table so that we have a chance to balance this nation and direct her towards due north. No, that's too much to ask on June the 17th, 5 years later. I started this conversation on body cameras in 2015, on the Walter Scott Notification Act in 2015. But no, we want to have a political conversation. I reject that. I reject that. And I will tell you that I believe that my friends on the other side of the aisle are serious about police reform. There's just some that are more interested in scoring political points than they actually are getting a result. Not the majority of them. The majority of them have the same heart that we have for the American people. That's where we should be focusing our attention on. Not the color of my skin, not tokens. Cool when you're out in the public. I get it all the time on Twitter. I'm used to it. But on this day, my heart aches for my state. My heart aches for my uncle's church for 50 years before he passed. And so I'm a little riled up. I sit here quietly trying to pass good legislation that was based on the House bill, because I knew that if I wanted a chance to get something done, we had to do it in a bipartisan fashion. I'm not running for anything. I'm not up for re-election. I'm not trying to support someone for their victory. I'm simply saying to the families I met with yesterday at the White House without a camera and in my office yesterday without a camera, I hear you. We see you. You are not simply sitting there silent. We are working on serious, tangible, measurable results. But why is that not enough? Why can't we just disagree on the three or four items that we disagree upon? Why can't I say what I've been saying, which is that the House bill is, in fact, the blueprint for some progress? It goes too far for me in some areas. But yes, I like the concept of more information. This is a good thing. The House does it. We do it. That's a good thing. I like the concept of more training. The House does it. We do it. I like the fact that we're looking for a way to ban chokeholds. We do it by taking money from different departments. They do it in a different fashion. But we're about 90% there. But where do we go? Where do we go? People wonder why our country's so divided, because it's so easy to walk on this floor and say token and send the same race-baiting message that we've heard for a very long time. But if you're a Democrat, hey, it's okay. That's not ever okay. It's not okay to say to our kids, you can't think what you want to think and be who you want to be. If you're not in line with one place and the way they think, this bad news, then you're a sellout. What message do you send to kids? I'm going to be okay. But what message are we sending to kids throughout our country? That you can't be taught just to think. We have to teach you how to think. That's the kind of conclusion that is wrong. It's toxic. It's pushing our country towards an implosion that is avoidable. That's why I started my legislative day today with remembering Mother Emanuel. It's why I read my Bible next because I knew I needed a little extra strength. And it's why I turned immediately to my first interview trying to talk about police reform, because as a guy who's been stopped 18 times in the years of the 2000s, I take it seriously. Being stopped 7 times in a single year, being stopped this year, being stopped last November, being stopped coming into the Senate with my pen on. Sure, I get it. But I don't point fingers at the other side saying that they're just not serious about the issue. It's just not what we should do. I assume that everybody should be serious about the issue. But Mr. President, I got to tell you, it's with a heavy heart. It's with a heavy heart that I believe that had we had more money for body cameras, we'd be in a different position today than we were in 2015, but I didn't have anybody who wanted to have this conversation, or at least we didn't have this conversation. I believe that there are good people of good intent on the other side of the aisle. I think there are good people of good intent on our side of the aisle. I think the fact of the matter is that most Americans are tired of Republicans and Democrats talking about Republicans and Democrats. I think most Americans are tired of us talking about election outcomes and polls. What about me is what they are saying. I'm suggesting that this bill, the Justice Act, is a serious nationwide effort tackling the issues of police reform, accountability, and transparency. It is grounded in bipartisan principles because I believe the other side has some stuff we have to hear and that our side has some stuff they need to hear. And if we do that, we'll have the votes to have a real debate next week on this bill. But if we don't do that, we'll just talk about scoring political points and you'll go on MSNBC or CNN, we'll go on Fox and everybody will have their chatter and more people in the communities of color will have less confidence in the institutions of power and authority in this nation because we missed the moment.
Tim Scott, Senator from South Carolina, laying the wood to not just Dick Durbin, but to the Democrats and to the media and to everyone else who will not take this issue seriously. And hats off to Senator Scott. Well and truly delivered. He overcame the emotion of the moment after being called a token. Good for Senator Scott. I'll be right back. Michael Oren joins me from Israel as annexation talk picks up there. We'll talk about the specifics when we return to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Still no news out of Hawaii, where Secretary of State Mike Pompeo continues his conversations with his counterpart from China, other than what I updated you on. I'm joined now by Dr. Michael Oren from Israel, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I am fine, Hugh.
Would you update us on the annexation debate in terms that the American public will understand, so they understand the decisions being made there and the decisions that will come here as a consequence?
Well, not untypically. The annexation debate is being presented in very black and white terms. Those who are against it saying it's going to be a disaster for our relations with the Palestinians, our relations with the Jordanians, with our relations with the Democratic Party. There's going to be an upheaval in the West Bank, security ramifications, and ultimately, by annexing great numbers of Palestinians, we will create a situation where it'll threaten our future as a democratic and Jewish state and make it very difficult to defend Israel internationally against charges of apartheid in the West Bank. That sounds pretty that's pretty bleak, right?
Yes.
But there's another side to it. There's another side to it, which is this, that the Trump peace plan is the best peace plan we've ever seen, certainly I've ever seen. And the only way to keep that peace plan alive is by upholding the principle that anybody who leaves the table pays a price. Now, the Palestinians have left the table repeatedly. They left it under Clinton. They left it under Bush. They left it under Obama. And rather than paying a price, they got paid. They got paid. They got rewarded. But under this president, every time they've left the table, they paid a price. The president recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, cut funding to the Palestinians all over the place. So now the Palestinians have left the table after the publication of the peace plan. There has to be some reaction from the parties to show that the peace plan is serious, or else it dies. It dies on the table. I've seen it happen again and again over the last 30 years. So you know, maybe there was a way of getting, say, the Saudis or the Emiratis to recognize Israel, to establish some type of level of diplomatic recognition that would achieve the same purpose. That has not happened, unfortunately, and so there doesn't seem to be much alternative. And then you know, the internal political situation, where the greatest opponents, at least in Israel, to the annexation are not from the left wing, but from the right wing, because they know that the quid pro quo for that annexation is Israel's recognition and acceptance of the Trump peace plan, which in one form or another calls for a two-state solution.
Now, Ambassador Oren, yesterday in D.C., a senior Emirati official gave a speech that suggested that the annexation moves would, in fact, rupture the ongoing approach of diplomatic relations with the Gulf states. What did you make of that?
I think he's being honest, but I would say to him in an honest and friendly way, okay, you don't want this to happen. What are you willing to do? Because something has to move here. Because if nothing happens, I think you agree with me, Hugh, if nothing happens, then the peace plan's dead. It's like every other peace plan, where the Palestinians got a veto, they said no, and everyone went home. They could do it again this time, but the only way around it is if the Palestinians realize that if they say no, other Arabs are going to say yes, and they're going to be left in the dust, the Palestinians. So I would say to the Emiratis, okay, you don't want Israel annexed, establish a legation. It doesn't even have to be an embassy, a legation. Let us open a legation. Let's have direct flights. Let's have business contacts, open business contacts. There's many things that can be done here. I don't see it happening.
Why would that explain to the unknowing? Why would something short of recognition move the process forward?
Well, first it would show the Palestinians if they don't move, they're going to be left behind.
Yeah.
That's a price they get. That's punishment for them. It also shows the Israeli public that there's a dividend, there's a peace dividend. And yes, there may be a recognition of some type of Palestinian state. It won't be a Weberian type state with full sovereignty, but a state. It'll involve territorial sacrifices for the Israelis. And, you know, we've made territorial sacrifices in the past. We didn't get peace. All we did was get tens of thousands of rockets. So you've got a very skeptical public here, justifiably. So you have to say here is a benefit. Guess what? You can get on a plane and do business in Abu Dhabi.
Now that makes sense. Okay. Now, in the Times of Israel, it says the prime minister has presented Benny Gantz with annexation options, including only a symbolic move. Would you explain to me does the prime minister have the votes to move unilaterally if he wants to move unilaterally towards one or the other of these options he's presented?
Well, he has like a doomsday button, which is this, that if Benny Gantz says no to these options, and I don't know if I entirely believe the Times of Israel article. I don't think the prime minister is looking for a symbolic annexation. I think he's looking for a substantive one. But having said that, if Benny Gantz says no, then the prime minister can say, well, we tried with blue and white and Benny Gantz. They're not playing ball with us. So we'll break apart the government and we'll go to, guess what, elections. And according to the recent polls, Benny Gantz and Blue and White have nosedived in the polls. BB has gone up to over 40 seats. And so if the elections happen quickly, and this is what they do happen quickly within 3 months, you could see the Prime Minister achieving a sweeping victory without anybody really in opposition. There's no opposition to him today.
And do you think that's what's going to happen, Michael Oren?
Well, according to the Israeli pundits, I think that's what's going to happen. I think it's definitely an option. I think they'll go for some type of level of annexation.
Okay, because Benny Gantz knows the same math, right? So if he knows the same math, he picks from...
It's existential for him.
Yeah, it is. I get it. Michael Oren, always a pleasure. You make it very clear, at least to me, maybe not the Steelers fans, but I appreciate it. Coming right back, America, hour number two, coming up on the You Do It Show.